Are you enjoying the music? I'm going to put a little bit of confidence in all the learning sessions to be able to help the job. You know, I'm going to make some of that up for you today. So, I want to, before we begin to keep up the panel, I want to get a special invite to have a platform sponsor from last night. Microsoft come up on the stage to say a few words. Anthony Salcido was one of the whiz kids that started before he actually graduated. In the first 9,000 employees at Microsoft. It sounds like it's growing only 10 times that, right? Please welcome him up to the stage.
I'm just going to say a few words, and I'm really happy to be here today. I had an opportunity to look through the program and see some of the sessions and dialogue, and I really call applause. There's a conversation that you all are having both here and in your institutions to really push the way technology impacts education. Microsoft certainly believes there's lots of progress that has been made. There's certainly lots more progress that needs to be made to really connect technology and education in more powerful ways. I really want to recognize John and Dr. Werner. They've been a great supporter of Microsoft and our platform technologies for a long time since their beginning. We continue to value their support and partnership and their work with all of you to push the work of technology and building down the road. So I applaud all of you guys as superheroes to the work that I do in my team every day. And I continue to be inspired by the story and the passion that you all bring to your institution. So I thank you for that. And so we want to move on to the big dialogue.
Also a couple of other announcements. I think maybe you can make some blogs or check this out. We're going to post this. We have a team, maybe they can stand up. One is very obvious in the Norm chat. Diane Lang, Kevin Chapman, and Brian Sackman. This is a team that represented us in Texas yesterday. We were with a lot of guys who were in the discussion today, but as maybe you probably are already aware, we're not in consent. So, yeah, we also have another special answer. We want to encourage you to leave a photo while you're here at this conference to share ideas with questions and comments. So, we managed to draw some support from our sponsors with Microsoft and BlackBerry. And we're giving away an additional Xbox and another BlackBerry tomorrow at lunchtime in the closing. So make sure you do this. That's for the job of as important as you can because you're picking the best at the best. So without any further ado, we're going to kick you over to the panel luncheon. This is going to be live and interactive. It's actually going to stream worldwide. Steve is going to talk a little bit about some of the technologies behind the scenes. We have wonderful experts lined up here today for you, talking about what's coming next when it comes to e-learning technology. We have Barry Dahl from Lake Superior College. He's also the author of the infamous entire blog. I think you need a new photo though for the logo. we also have the infamous Stephen Downs, who's both the author of Stephen's web collaborative learning development, as well as the National Research Council Research Officer, Mr. Kendall. So thank you very much for coming. Michael Wellstein, who is also an author of another blog called The Literate, and also a local. And Dr. Robin Melton, who's obviously a number one client. I wouldn't say that up here, but actually I just did. she paid me to say that, by the way. we've heard a lot about the next generation technology at this particular event, and a lot of you have incredible ideas for where we should be going as an organization to take this technology to the next level. We want to make sure that we're hearing those voices, and your dialogue is a very important part of this panel discussion today. So I'm going to make sure that Stephen has an opportunity to describe how you're going to be able to interact with this panel, and I look forward to hearing the discussion.
That's from Stephen.
Hello, everybody, and hello to everybody out there on the world. here. This panel discussion is being live streamed now to the world wide web as I speak. I'll have a use stream. So we'll be having participants all here in this room and participants around the world. You might ask them, how are they going to participate? We also have running what is called the back channel. The back channel is a way for people to input comments into a web-based forum, and then those comments will be displayed on the screen. So, in a few minutes, we'll be showing you the address for that. So, if you've got your computers with you, if you want to have access, or your DBAs, or anything that you access from this web forum, you will be able to upload those comments. If you do not have such a thing with you, we also have a trial room. Computers and over there as well. Where you can just sort of sneak over there and all you can see in typing your comments, and it too will show up on your screen. The way we have our panel discussion, the theme of the panel discussion is something like what each of us would like to see in the future of e-learning. And so each of us is going to speak for a very brief time on what of these things that we would like to see in e-learning. And then after that, we're holding it up to general discussion along with our fellow Microsofts or swimming insults or compliments or whatever you want back and forth. I'm quite a bit of on this too. We also have a couple of microphones, and I'm not sure where they are right now. When we start comments, the microphones will be placed into your hands somewhere. We will not control the microphones. We expect you, the members of this discussion, to pass that microphone around person to person, and whoever has the microphone at any given time is able to speak up and join in the discussion. The whole idea, the whole concept, is to put as much of this discussion into the hands of everybody here as possible, so that we're not running the whole show from up here on the stage. The actual control of this session is in very significant ways being handed over to you, both on the screen and in the audio conversation. So with that, and the launch this is our first participant.
That's not going to work. See, that thing doesn't work, Barry.
It doesn't work.
No, so just signal to me when you want a slide.
Like that.
Like that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to maybe take a little different angle. I thought about this whole question, what's the one thing you like to see me learning? I kept coming back to me, I'm plugging my head up against all the time these days. And it's not what I want in the next iteration of Geek Around. It's not what I'm working on the mobile or anything like that. Is what that says on the screen is red. Make sure that the layers don't screw things up. And, you know, at my college, we've been going on our degree program for about 11 years. Now, I heard Dave from RIT this morning say they had an online program back in 1991. And so, you know, a lot of us have made good progress on this. And, you know, I just pulled up, it looks like a revolution change over here, but Project Model is a vision innovation. And I'm sure you've seen this before, but it's my contention that right now we're in danger of what I'm going to lump all into the laggards, even though I'm really talking about the late majority and the laggards. Some kind of a fast twitch guy, so if you're late majority, you're a laggard, it's my other contention as well. And so most of the people in this room fall into those first couple of categories, at least in the early majority, you know, it's clear that these are not well defined. But what I'm seeing now are several of them. How people are coming to the game after we've made substantial progress. And I think that there's a danger of them kind of messing up some of the good things that we've had going on. So just to give you a couple of examples, and I'll take my seat again. The first example has to do with what I'll call laggard faculty. And I'm not trying to speak ill of faculty members, but I was one of the 17 years myself. But what I'm seeing happen on my own campus is throughout our state system, I'm from Minnesota, by the way, is that we have faculty members who have basically been bad on e-learning for, you know, the duration going down the road, and all of a sudden they decided they want to play in the sandbox with us. And oftentimes not for the right reasons, at least that's what I've been saying in kind of cases. And so they come to e-learning without a passion for it, they come to e-learning, sometimes to get an extra paycheck for whatever reason it might be. And you know, I don't think that I'm preaching to the choir here, because I don't think we fall in that category. But they're out there, and we're seeing it. And what happens in particular on my campus, we have people with 9, 10, 11 years of experience who are really good online teachers. And we're having a hard time keeping them employed because we have some people, whether they have tenure or other ways that they can push themselves to the front of the line. And we're losing some of our best teachers to replace them with basically a newbie who doesn't even want to do this. So I see that as a problem. We'll just give you a couple other examples on this one. The second example is just broadening it out a little bit. I come from a state where we have a consortium of 32 schools. And so the 32 schools, obviously, there's some similarities to that fusion curve as well. Some of us were the early adopters and innovators, and now we've got schools that are coming again in what I would say in the last half of that curve. And that's fine. Nobody's telling me that they can't do that. The problem is we're not managing our growth. And so because students still enroll regionally and they learn about this more than anything else, where a school like myself and a few others in this program have been out there serving the population for quite a few years, we now have growth happening that is duplicative to the much of the same programs and courses. And so if you look at it from a state system level, what's happening is we are filling courses with a new school with a new faculty member and less courses at a school with a lot of experience faculty. And so from a system theory point of view, that doesn't make any sense at all. And I think the students are losing in that sort of situation. And I put this up there just to show you, this goes back to fall of 04. And fall of 04 is before a lot of these other schools decided that they were going to come along. They were kind of waiting for us to fail, and it didn't happen. And so that's the type of enrollment pattern we had just primarily in Minnesota there. But what's happened now over the last few years is a lot of those students choose a more local provider. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, I'm just saying that from the perspective of whether the student's getting the best quality education or replacing qualified faculty or experienced faculty with newbies. And I don't think that that's probably the way that we want to do it. So if you're not managing that growth, that's what's happening. And the third example, I'm hoping the U.S. Congress gets to the laggard category a little bit. This is actually changing. Apparently it's changing, but the language of the Higher Ed Act, I've been kind of vocal about this, and it's the case of where the student authentication language for distance learning is in the Higher Ed Act that should be passed in the next one to do. That's had a lot of us on edge, which is exactly what that means. You know, is everybody going to have test proctoring for all kinds of different things and or extreme measures possibly? I just want to let you know that I came back from the ITC board meeting just a couple of days ago, and the chair of the ITC, that's the Instructional Technology Council, shared with me some language. In fact, go to my blog, you'll see a poster near the top, I think I did it yesterday, that has the clarifying language for what they mean by student authentication. And as long as that clarifying language stays attached to the bill, we probably can sleep a little easier, because it's not the doom and gloom that it sounds like. But I'm still going to leave them in here as coming to the party a little bit late and acting on anecdotal evidence and no real measure of a true problem. And so until I'm going to leave them on the list so I know for sure that they're not going to mess things up for us. And so those are my examples. I don't think I have those slides as a check to make sure. I do not. So I will leave it at that and make your comments.
You have to do the same thing for me.
I've changed my little tale three or four times in this talk, but I actually settled on open educational resources. What are open educational resources? Basically, at the most simple level, open educational resources are free digital resources that can be used to support learning. In this case, the reason why I got involved in this field in the first place. Off the live streaming. I think I already.
Yeah, it is me. Well, they're supposed to control that. All right.
How's that? Much better. Sorry about that, world. It speaks to the reason why I got involved in this in the first place. For me, attaining an education was something of a challenge because I didn't come from the most wealthy background in the world. And this is a challenge faced by most of the people in the world today. And we're not going to solve this challenge for most people in the world today. They're building more buildings and doing education in an expensive way. So making learning resources freely available to everybody in the world is probably my number one priority for the future. What is free? The definition varies. Free is often thought of as free as in beer, as in free beer, as in you don't have to pay for it. And to me, that's a big part of free educational resources, also educational resources. But I also think of free in terms of the four freedoms outlined by Richard Stallman, the freedom to run or to read or to access the resource, whatever the resource may be, the freedom to study the resource, that is to say, to look at the resource in its original encoding, so that you don't have to do the resource through some proprietary viewing system. Freedom to redistribute or to share the resource is very important. And then finally, the freedom to improve, to correct the spelling on improve, to modify the resource is also a fundamental freedom. There are different types of open education resources, and these will vary according to license types. One of the earliest licensing system for open educational resources is the GNU Free Documentation License. And this is a license that actually accompanies documentation that is distributed with open source software and lays up the parameter for distributing documentation as freely open source software. More recently, we've seen online the proliferation of Creative Commons licenses, and these licenses are used by people to make websites, videos, photographs, or any sort of multimedia freely available for people to use and to use. And I want to mention as well David Wiley's open publication license, which addresses some of the weaknesses in both the new free documentation license and the Creative Commons licenses. What are the differences among these licenses? Are there different types or different ways you can distribute content for free? And there are four major conditions that can be attached to the free distribution of content. That's why Creative Commons has the tagline, some rights reserved. Even with open source software, when open source software is distributed freely, what is important in that distribution is that it continues to be freely distributable. It's not like you can distribute it freely and the next person in the chain can lock it down and say nobody else can access it. So the share alike condition, which I mentioned before, is one of the fundamental conditions of free and open software. The idea that it continues to be free even after it has been given away. A condition that's very important to most academics is attribution, or giving credit to the source of whoever created the open source material. Another condition that generates a lot of discussion and argumentation in the field is whether or not commercial or use is allowed. There are some major open educational resources sites that restrict use to non-commercial purposes, and others that don't free means commercial use. And then finally, the question of whether derivatives can be made or whether the content that was distributed must be distributed in exactly the same form. And typically, any distribution of free and open educational resources will include one or more than one of these four conditions. And these four conditions basically create different types of free content. Now, there are many examples of free and open educational resources. The most well-known is the MIT OpenCourseWare. There's also the British Open University's OpenLearn project. There's WikiEducator, as well as Wikipedia, and there are many others like that. Many sources of free and open educational
access to these resources, and this is where some of your own work begins to come into play. One way is to put the resource into an institutional repository. My own organization, the National Research Council of Canada, just announced that it is going to require all of our researchers to take our published materials and put them into an institutional archive so that they will be freely available to everybody in Canada and around the world. And this is something I very much support. You can use systems like Open Archives Initiative or the DSpace repository, or you can use the Desire to Learn repository to make your content freely openly accessible. Or many people use online storage sites such as Flickr for photographs, YouTube for video, Internet Archive, and Our Media for other multimedia files. Or you can take part in content creation in a content creation site such as Wikipedia or any of the other Wiki projects, or a system like Rice's Connections, which is a place where you can go to create online courses. People very often say, well, how do you make this work if you don't charge for the materials? And this is something that people in the field of open educational resources have thought about a lot. I've linked to a paper that I've written on this. There are many ways to make open educational resources sustainable. You can consider it as part of your institutional mandate, as MIT does. You can obtain base government funding, such as NSF or even HERIT. You can consider it as a volunteer opportunity. You have volunteers create the site on an ongoing basis, which is what Wikipedia, Wiki Educator does. It can be contracted out with some sort of public-private partnership. You can get foundation support. The Hewlett Foundation especially is very well known for supporting open educational resources. Or there can be corporate funding for these resources. And the ones that are most relevant to me are the NITOG how-to videos for digital photography. What I'd like to see is going forward, because the temptation is to use a system like a learning management system. It's like you've got this instant monopoly on your hand, right? All your students go to your learning management system, and the temptation is to use your learning management system as a cash cow and use this as a place where you're going to demand or require that people purchase commercial materials at inflated prices from publishers, not from the bookstore, of course, because they don't use the bookstore for a learning management system. But what I would like to see is the learning management system, and talk to Blackboard people about this as much as I can, the learning management system used to facilitate and support the open sharing of free educational resources. My belief is that a system like Desire to Learn going forward should be the place where you get free online educational resources, where you're not locked into publishers' contracts and commercial media, where you can share the content freely among yourself and among the time with the rest of the world. And that's where I'll stop. We'll move on to the next person. Thank you.
Like this. I'm going to take a different approach regarding one thing I would like to see in the next 3 to 5 years. You need to know that I am blessed to be a teacher. So regardless of the technology, regardless of all of the issues and policies, I would like a different approach in the next 3 years for online. So, if you would look up to the screen and go in the world, if you could just imagine having a student with some earphones on, and yes, this can work, and Robbie, teacher, is somewhere, someplace, and I have a student who is studying and part of my online course, and all of a sudden that student pulls up a module and goes, or what, or why? And all of a sudden with those earphones on, it was thin, some type of transmission from that headset to that computer and alerted me that a student is having a problem. Wouldn't that be a amazing. In other words, it would just get into my email to say Nicole Kendall was stuck on a problem. And it would buy brainwaves. That's what I would like to see. So, John Baker, Microsoft, and all of the rest of you here, move me past all of is a student, is really a student online. I want to teach. So I challenge all to say, give me a tool that my students can hook up, and when they are stuck, they would instantly email me just by going through me.
I do want to take just 1 minute before I get into the meat of things and say two.
We get into the meat of things and say two. Make two points by way of introduction. Number one, tomorrow I will be speaking as an employee of the Oracle Corporation. Today I am speaking as an independent.
My employer generally allows me to say whatever I want as long as I give them false deniability. So, the second thing that I want to say is happy I am to be here today. I've heard a lot of folks talking in their sessions about the values that they get from the desire to learn software. And that's great and that's important, but I also want to emphasize that it is equally important to be thinking about the values of the organizations, the vendors that you work with. It is both as educators, I think we're very much aware of issues of values. It's what drives us. I saw some from remembering our business relationships that we have both a it's both in our enlightened self-interest and it is a moral obligation for us to demand from the companies that we work with good values. And I think you're getting plenty of that here from this company this week. So, my proposal, I don't have slides, I am the slacker of the group, and that's much like our time anyway. My proposal comes from the reactions that I got to a blog post, actually, about the desire to learn feature not too long ago. I sat down with some folks here who gave me a review of the learning objectives capability. And I wrote a couple of posts about it. I got what struck me as some strange reactions to it. This is one of those cases that I see so often when there are two very different communities that are thinking about educational technology. You can call one group the edupunks, the sort of ground up independent teachers who close the door of their classroom and do what they need to for their students. Do everything they can, but students are fairly suspicious of too much bureaucracy and too many rules, and really accomplish what they do by figuring out what's right and just doing it. And then you have the technocrats, I guess you'd call them, the folks who work for the system and believe in the system's lead and the system's ability to help deliver high quality education and better outcomes for students. And they had two very different reactions to, I should say, in some ways they got two very similar reactions, this notion of learning objectives, which is to say, if what he's saying is what you mean by learning objectives, if what she's saying is what you mean by learning objectives, then I'm not interested, I don't want that. And it's particularly odd because both groups really have a need to suit their different purposes. For this. So I'm going to take let's say, a pro-institution and an anti-institutional view and make a case in both cases of what we really need. Let's not call it learning objectives because I think people trip on that term. Let's call it nutritional labeling in educational units. And that could be something very small, single page learning object. It could be an entire course or an entire program of study or anything in between. So on the on the economic side of the spectrum, if you listen to Stephen talk about open educational resources, if you think about the possibilities that opens for me as a student, I can go in and I can make my own path, create my own educational experience. And that's another thing, but you kind of need some of the trail markers to know that the possibilities are. And this is a very hard problem, even when we're just talking about granular design objects. But if I want to, I want to say, I want to be this kind of person with these kinds of skills, and I have a path that I'm going to make for myself, I need to be able to navigate that, put together a curriculum for myself. I need nutritional labeling in education units so that I can see what I get from each piece and put the program together and just go through it. On the other side, if I'm an institution person, I'm a technocrat. We have a problem here in the United States about transfer credits. This is an example. Student goes to a two-year institution, gets a degree, moves on to a four-year institution. Four-year institution has to look at those credits and say, I've got to make sense of this. How is this going to work? Which credits are going to transfer? And for what? And which requirements? And it's a bad problem here. But it's not so bad that we're actually motivated to fix it. We just kind of It's actually a much worse problem in continental Europe, where you're transferring credits between universities that have entirely different educational structures between, say, Germany and the Netherlands, or even Germany and the UK. And you're also dealing with language differences, you're dealing with very deep cultural differences, and there's a huge issue for Europe. And so they started what they call the Bologna process, which is essentially to come up with nutritional labeling for their learning units so that students who move from one program to another will, after they've graduated, move on to the job market. Can show what it is they've done in relation to sense of all the people involved. So the schools to which they are matriculated will understand what they've done and how that relates to the program that's available. So in both cases, we need nutritional labeling for our education units. It is a difficult problem to solve. The two groups, the technocrats and the educators, are going to have different approaches to them. The technocrats are going to tend to gravitate towards bottom-up solutions like tagging. The technocrats are going to tend to gravitate towards top-down solutions. We know that tagging and taxonomies work together. We know that it takes a lot of community and collaboration to come up with these systems of organization that work for everyone. So I'd really like to see these two groups figure out a way to come together. Maybe find some common ground where differences are so stark in their philosophies, such as lifelong learning. So there's my thing.
So that's everyone, and I'm going to stay here to do the next part of this. We're all going to be here. We've got our lapel mics on. For those of you who wanted to see the streaming, please don't hit the streaming too hard. D2L has done a fantastic job with the wireless for the second day here, but that might still be pushing it if everybody hits the streaming. But there it is, fusion2008.desiretolearn.com/expert panel is where the live streaming is happening right now. But you may want to go to this page, downs.ca/cgibin/cchat.cgi. This is the page that you access when you want to put your comment in. And this page now is going to be displaying your comments. Your comment, when you type it in, your comment will show up there for 10 seconds, and then it's gone into the dustbin of history. So, hi, Gene. And so they will show up. If you want to see the archive of the comments, archives can be accessed from the comment type-in form. So, makes sense to everyone? Perfectly clear? The URL comes back up when the queue of comments empties. So if you forgot it, you may have missed it. But it's downs.ca/cgibin/cchat.cgi. Or if you go to the page where it's streaming, you can also see it. Or again, if you've forgotten it, go to the computers on the sides where you'll see it as well. Also, we have the traveling microphones. There they are at the start of the room. You want to just hand them to people. Pass those microphones around. And if you have something to say, this is a bit chaotic, but if you have the microphone, you want to say something, speak, or if you don't, just pass it on to someone.
Four question marks and three exclamation points, so I guess that is more of a question than a statement. So how do we stop the laggers? We don't stop them, but I think that we need to manage the process a little bit better. I will tell you that in education, we oftentimes think we can't say no to something, whatever it might be. You know, I'm going to teach that class. Well, maybe the right answer is no sometimes. And I think that we just have to manage the situation. I think being aware of it, and it may not be affecting you the way I've been seeing it, but I do think that that we have issues of maintaining the quality and the progress that we've been made, because this probably isn't for everybody. But good management at the campus and system level is what I'm looking for.
I just want to add sort of a perspective for what's good. Personally, one of the reasons why I like education technology was precisely because it was for the practice. And it seems to me that teaching online is such a strange and dislocating experience, and it upsets our ingrained habits, for better or for worse, of teaching, enough that professors who are not necessarily teachers, they profess, which is different than teaching, may actually feel dislocated about what they've become and have a conversation about pedagogy in using these tools. And so I wholeheartedly agree with everything about the dangers about people coming in for the wrong reasons. At the same time, I think it's important to see the opportunity. This is a once-in-a-generation chance to talk to people who are in charge of education about what it means to teach well. And we really should carpe diem.
So Robbie, do you want to answer that question that just came up?
Yes, you have to look on my face.
Yes.
First of all, online teaching is a tool that takes time and effort. It's not something where you can just go online and have the time. Therefore, we have to look at workflow. When we have that standard, you know, you teach four courses a semester, whatever, we have to take a different look at that. We all know, and again, you can attest to, that email, getting online, getting feedback to those students take time and effort. So maybe looking at workflow issues in terms of a virtual university versus your traditional, you see, you answer. So again, you have to look at it from another point of view. The more questions and email I'm receiving will allow me to teach a little better.
Okay, I want to see if there's any comments from the microphones that are circulating around. I don't know where they are right now. They may have left the room.
I have Freebird on my computer here. I could play if we need to.
Yeah, we will. I see one of them. It's moving. Where's the other one?
Okay, I just want to pick up and say that Dr. Romney, you've done a very good job of innovating something that will help the teaching and learning process. Thank you.
Excellent.
I've got a question. With so much changes in the demographics of the students that we're primarily serving, the population is aging, people in the workforce are needing more training and retooling. What about the idea with the open content on sites of having subscription-based education, the same way that we have have 19 subscriptions. So that you can attend classes in order to update your skills. You don't have to go through the registration processes. You don't have to worry about transfer credits, because it's more about what you want to learn and what you want to learn.
There's a question that's come up a couple of times here now on the screen, probably by the same person, about how online environments and multi-user virtual environments will impact the future of e-learning. And I'm not convinced that they're going to have as huge an impact as is touted for them. I think that online environments, especially 3D environments, play a useful role in simulating certain types of virtual reality, such as you walk in and around molecules and things like that, or crash jet airplanes to the sides of mountains. But I think that most learning will continue to be the interaction of people with each other rather than the interaction with, never display the back channel on screen. But that's where the fun is, the interaction with each other rather than the interaction with the software. Mike?
Yeah, I guess we need the last question. Deferring to Stephen on that one, but actually related to his answer, which is the notion of free and freely accessible subscription open education is very, very attractive, obviously. If you're a teacher, you believe that's what it's all about. It's about changing the world through more access to the product, the better. There are a number of practical challenges to that. One is that schools have to find a way to, have to be sustainable financially. It's not something we, it's in all seriousness, it's not something we like to think about. It's education we like to choose to have. But we do, especially if we like to get salaries. There are ways to do that. And I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's something that needs to be thought about seriously. The other thing, this ties into what Stephen was saying. I'm a big believer in teachers. I think, all this laudable and correct conversation that we have periodically about, we need to be more student-centered. That's all true, but I also think we tend to throw the baby out of the bathwater. I believe in the power of teachers. And so the notion of all subscription courses, I think it has its place. It worries me when we draw a picture in which the teacher is the color of the feedback.
Now, let's go back to the microphone that's in the room. We had a request from the back that whoever has the microphone to stand up. That's up to you if you want to speak kind of anonymously, but if you want to be on camera, please stand up. And there you go.
Yes, I was just wondering about the schools that you develop curriculum on their time. They pretty much take ownership of that. How do you transition that into a free educational system?
Well, what happens there is you convince the school, the institution, the organization to adopt a policy of mandated institutional open access provisioning. Just like my own organization, the National Research Council of Canada owns the stuff that I write, which is kind of an odd feeling, but it does. But the NRC now has this policy of mandated open access so that my material is made free as an institutional mandate. And any institution that owns material can make it available for free and still retain the rights to that material. You don't give away the right, you don't give away your ownership, but you make the material open access. Anyone else want to?
I think it goes back to values. Teachers have this, a lot of teachers that I've spoken to, great people, right people. But they have this notion that something's being taken from them. When someone uses their content. And the same people, by the way, are happy to write or even edit a journal for free that their library then pays thousands of dollars in subscription for. So there's a little bit of inconsistency there. We need to remind them of what Thomas Jefferson said, which was paraphrasing, I can like your candidate without extinguishing mine. Sharing knowledge, if you knew knowledge, doesn't take anything away from me. Teachers fundamentally understand that. There's something that funny that happens when they think about something that could, in principle, be owned and have monetary value, even if in practice it doesn't have monetary value.
Okay, Robbie, did you want to answer this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Question. Again, I'm looking towards the future. And the question, and I'll just kind of paraphrase it, is when you are engaged with a student, wherever you are, whether you be right in front of them, face to face, or online, your job as a teacher is to share, motivate, facilitate information. What's missing right now online, and I'm speaking asynchronously, okay? You have to wait. So if my friend here is online and he has a question or he's confused, there's nowhere visually or something to say to Robbie, who's at the future conference, he's online and he needs help. All I'm asking, because I'm thinking way out of the box, that there should be something that would trigger an email or something to say he's stuck on the problem. And when I'm able to give right back. Yes, that sounds futuristic, but that's what we're here for. Because 8 years ago, on behalf of the Tennessee Board of Regents, we never thought we would have a youth online degree program. We never thought we could collaborate. We never thought we would have a common calendar. We never thought we would have a common curriculum. We never thought that we would be here.
Okay, for those of you wondering about AnyMouse is the anonymous user. Anonymous, is AnyMouse, anonymous, dead. Mary?
Was it AnyMouse? I'm not sure. But someone on the back channel asked the question about what lessons can the experienced higher ed types in the room provide to the K-12 online learning newbies? And just a couple of quick thoughts on that. One, I had the privilege of going out to Staples, Minnesota a month or so ago and address a group of about 30 high school faculty members who were just starting an online school. It was at the local school, but the district was providing online learning starting in the fall, and they were starting their training in June. But it was a good group to speak to because they had all kinds of kind of myths and fears about what they were walking into. And there's a lot of this development happening at the K-12 level, especially at the high school level. Just really ramping up. But the one thing I think is that they absolutely can learn from a lot of our the travels we've been down this road for 10 to 20 years, depending on where you're from. And it strikes me that there's a big difference between classroom education at the K-12 level and classroom education at the higher ed level. I think there's a big difference. I think there's a much smaller difference in online teaching and learning at the K-12 level and online teaching and learning at the higher ed level. I think they're much more similar to one another than the classroom stuff is. So I think that we have a lot of experience that we need to share with them. And I'll leave it at that.
I'm going to turn the Moodle question over to Michael in a moment, but I want to see, first of all, and maybe I'm done with the API question. But first of all, I'd like to see where the microphones are. If there's any voice with a microphone that would like to make their comments known. How are the mics doing? I can't see. No?
AnyMouse.com, have you registered that?
No, I haven't, actually. All right, Michael, why don't you... why don't you talk about open source and will Moodle or Sakai or whatever overtake Desire to Learn and that other company?
Sure, this is another one of those things where people get religion, and I once was told that there are two kinds There was a Mark the Jew and Mark the Bee. The people who wanted to pick up a few tips from her about how to do things, and the people who just wanted to be Mark the Steward. And I think a similar thing applies to open source. There's open source of you and open source of me.
That's what you call mobile computing.
Yeah. I'm an open source of you kind of guy. It's really kind of disturbing when you're on stage when I chat to you know, open source and proprietary software are two ways of collecting resources to get work done, and they both work, and they both have their strengths and their weaknesses. I can speak for a moment from my employer, who sell a lot of proprietary software, and use a lot of open source. I think as long as companies deliver a good platform, they will continue to do business. Open source is one of the commodification pressures. Where, you know, we continually set the bar on what's available free, at least in terms of license fees, and they provide a different way for people to participate and contribute. But I'm not going to predict whether Google and Sakai are going to wipe out, even if I weren't a guest in somebody else's home, I wouldn't be smart enough to predict who's going to win and who's going to lose here. I think that at the end of the day, who wins and loses is based on who does the best job. And that's for you all. So.
And I've got a challenge.
Go for it.
This is a new technology for all of us, where you have a panel, but we also have this live interactive chat. And as you see, some of the comments coming across are, you know, on task and on task. As an instructor, I ask all of us in technology, how would you handle this situation? You know, in a traditional sense, we would say just turn off all of the devices and the electricity. But this is a new age. We're multitasking. For those who are on another tab, but showing others, how would you engage them? And that's what's happening. That's the beauty, I mean, the beauty of teachable moments. How do we handle this?
Anyone with the microphone want to answer that?
Yeah, let's check back.
How would you handle it? Whoever has the microphone now. Don't pass it on. The microphones are gone. Where are the microphones? How would you handle this in your class, someone with a microphone? The audience didn't want the responsibility of handling the microphone. That's interesting.
I think I do
what
I would do if you had a teachable moment. I think that it's actually a demonstration of what doesn't have any classrooms today without kind of technology. If you're a crack school teacher, people are going to do the crosswords or something else. You can have humor and sidebars and still learn. The conversation is going on really well, thanks, and I love the humor. Keep it up.
I think one of the challenges here in the class is you know, especially the older you get, your brain just doesn't work that fast. And so I'm missing, I have trouble noticing things like, you know, traffic lights, never mind, you know, 10-second blur flashing on the screen. So, you know, it really challenges us to be lifted up, I guess, by our students. To roll with it, to know if you miss the original Google question and just say something, you know. To not be afraid, to be treading water. And I think that's really, when we get back to Darius' earlier point about guidance, you know, it's really about There's a lot here that can make you feel like me. So the solution is to get used to feeling like me. We all are. We're all idiots. If we're lucky, we're occasionally idiots among us.
And would it not be beautiful that an instructor would know his or her content so well that upon any question coming across or any statement, you would be able to grab it, use it, and put it back into a concept in that subject matter?
Barry?
I don't have anything to say about that. But there is a question. I'm not even sure if it's come up yet. Maybe it did, but they were asking the Tennessee K-12 folks would like to ask the friends at Georgia Virtual School for tips in helping to set up a similar system in Tennessee. So maybe you can facilitate some sort of interaction between those groups. Because I believe Georgia Virtual School is here somewhere, represented.
Well, I saw some hands waving.
Actually, before they ask the question, on the screen right now, I was going to mention this. Michael Wesch, if you're familiar with his viral videos on YouTube, those are all great and all, but you can also see video of a full presentation that he does where he shows you how he's using technologies like these in the classroom with about 100 students or something like that, 80 to 100 students at a time. I know at the manitoba.edu website you can find that. If you just search for it, it's been out there a lot. But if you watch through it, there's a big segment in there of how he's using technologies like this. And it's a little bit different because the students are interacting much more than this kind of, you're sitting there and we're sitting up here. But he's using these technologies in very innovative ways, and I suggest you check it out.
It's kind of interesting, too. We're not really feeling this overtly, but keep in mind as well, this is being broadcast over the web. I'm not sure how many people are watching it, but people on the web are watching this and probably feeding in comments to the system as well. So,
well, there's 49 people viewing right now.
There's 49 people viewing us on the web right now.
And a few of them, I'm sure, are in this room, but not all of them.
Well, 49 computers, there's probably some in rooms. Person on the mic, anybody on the mic got a comment or a question? How are our mics doing there? I see someone standing up.
Well, while we're waiting, I'll mention something that was going to be my topic today. And at the product launch yesterday, John and Jeremy talked about the issue I was going to bring forward, and that has to do with, even though I feel like we've made great progress in e-learning, and some of us are developing a lot of experience with this, we've done such an incredibly poor job of using the data that's available. And so the whole data analytics piece, the whole using it for predictive analysis and that sort of thing, and what part of the problem is it's been difficult to get to the data, although I think that for a lot of us we would struggle with what to do with it if we did get to it or easily. But that's I think, an issue that we can really learn more about what's happening. And for the Desire to Learn users, I think that their development in that area, it's pretty exciting to me.
It's just the question, would you rather have people post these comments on Facebook or on here? I think it's an interesting, I think it's liberating to know what people are actually thinking. Because I give lots of talks, and after a little while you can delude yourself that you're interesting. And a system like this brings you back down to earth in a hurry, but it really lets you know. And like, people are thinking these things anyways, and we might as well not pull the wool over our eyes. People are thinking these things and saying themselves to each other. Having it on the screen in front of us, now we know what they're thinking and saying, and that's only liberating in my eyes. Mike? And humbling. Very, very, also very humbling.
Something very special. Edgy punks versus technocrats, and about the soul analytics thing. I know that a lot of folks who are educators get very nervous when we start, and not just educators, their risk when we start gathering too much data on what students are doing, that it starts to feel like there are, you know, maybe some privacy issues and some things that are a little bit unsettling. So I want to sort of suggest a different way to think about these analytics issues. You know, suppose you don't show them anymore to the students. But we know that people tend to be more optimistic about how they're doing. There was a survey of MBA students who understand what statistics mean and understand that the median means exactly in the middle, 50% below, 50% above. And when they were asked about the decile, they thought they were in the class in terms of their achievement. 95% of them thought they were above average. And then faculty members, when you ask them, they had to be slightly better in a different study. 94% of faculty members thought they were above average teachers. And if you've ever worked with average students, you know that one of their big problems is they don't know how to do it. Right? So if you combine analytics, and let's just say you're confident on whether you're going to show it to anyone else, so the students, forget that. I'm just going to let a student know. Here's how you're doing compared to your cohort. Here's what your performance is. Usually, the rest of your class is turned into three more assignments than you have. You haven't logged in 3 weeks, whatever the case may be. Well, that's tremendously valuable. We can only get that via analytics and data. What we need to do is create an architecture of privacy where we can decide on a policy base starting with the student and then going up successively who has access to this data. But I think we can't be afraid to know more.
Okay, and on that note, and then, in the spirit of not being afraid, we're going to wrap up this panel discussion. I think that it was a pretty brave thing for Desire to Learn to allow us to try to pull something like this off at the conference, because we know all the ways this could have blown up. But I really thank all of you for your participation, everybody else in the panel. And so we're going to wrap up our session right now and bring Don back up to the stage. So thank you very much.
Thank you.